Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunasov. With me as always.
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben 34. And with us for the very first time is our special guest and good friend Dane Krams. Hello, Dane.
Hello.
Dane Krams.
Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. I'm good.
That's nice.
How's Milton doing, Dane?
Speaking of Milton, yeah, he's here, curled up right under the desk.
What a special cat.
He's part of the podcast. He's come to join in.
Good.
We invite cats to our podcast, except Percy, because she's noisy.
Yeah, she is noisy, and she no longer lives with me, so anyway.
No.
Yes.
For those of you that don't know of Dane's work, he's...
Shame on you! That's all I have to say.
He does lovely, lovely high-res clean art. If you haven't played either Anna's Quest Volume 1 or Egress, then go and play at least one, preferably two of those games. Beautiful, beautiful high-res art and good storytelling and beautiful animation. Really nice stuff. And why are you not playing it now?
Oh, shucks.
Well, because they have to listen to our podcast first, then they can go play.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I don't know
how much we can give away, but do you still use AGS, Dane, or have you moved on to Visionaire?
I have moved on to Visionaire, yes.
I thought so. Are we allowed to talk about why, or is that still very secret?
It's very secret, yes.
That's what I thought. Alright, so we won't, okay. but good things are happening for Dane Krams, so
yes.
We'll leave it at that.
Good.
So, yeah. So he may have abandoned AGS like a filthy yellow-bellied traitor who gutted and hung in a gibbet, but he's still welcome on our podcast.
Yes.
But I have noticed that I've been away from the AGS forums because of that for a while, and I did duck in again recently just to see how things were going, and I noticed that there's like a kind of official release of the engine now that's properly supporting high res. Is that right?
There's about 500 different releases versions of the engine because ever since it went open source, it's kind of branched out. I mean, I haven't really been paying too much attention myself because I'm still working with 3.1 because I hate change and I hate updating. But as far as I can tell, they're kind of trying to corral all the extreme features together in one sort of base engine. But yeah, it's still very much in constant beta.
Yeah.
So.
And why would you think that we'd know anything about high res?
Yeah.
Developments of the engine. We're low res guys through and through.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you're AGS guys. You're more AGS guys than me. I'm out of the loop.
Yeah. Well, we can't all be revolting traitors.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should probably...
What have you been playing lately?
Hold on. Before we get into that, let me just add a thing, because if people are still saying, who the heck is... Well, they know who the heck Dane Krams is, but we should also mention that we, during our excursion known as Bogans last year, we met up with Dane, and Dane was kind enough to let you stay at his house for a few days and let me stay at his house, as well as you, for the last night I was in Brisbane, and we had adventures with funny hats and... Hercules Pirate.
Yeah.
They were good times. Yeah. No, Dane was very kind. I thought he'd honestly just let me sleep on the couch, but he gave me a bed and he came out and partied with us and we had a great time. So
yeah, Dane's he came out and partied with us and Dane is a true friend to the animals.
Fall victim to hype and sort of building someone up too much just because they came on the podcast, but he is in fact the best and coolest person in the world. So, without building
and I'm such a nice host, Ben, that even when you broke my blind in the bedroom, I didn't say anything about it. I just left it.
Break your blind.
Intrigue.
I think you unknowingly broke it by force. Benjamin pulled on the blind with sheer force and broke the cables, but that's okay. I'm a nice host.
I remember all the interesting stuff we did, but I do. I remember doing all sorts of amazing. Did I really break your blind?
Yeah, but it's okay. We fixed it.
Maybe I did it in my sleep because I honestly don't remember doing it.
Maybe, yeah, maybe it was Milton sabotaging you.
Probably not. It was probably me. Anyway, what games have you been playing, Dane? We always talk about what stuff we've been playing lately, so tell us what we've been playing, what you've been playing.
Well, I'm guessing you've probably already talked about it, but me, like every other adventure game fan, has been playing Broken Age.
We haven't,
because neither of us have played it.
So, yeah.
What? But you were a backer, weren't you?
I wasn't. I back unpopular Kickstarters, not popular ones. I'm like a hipster of Kickstarter.
Yeah. you're a hipster.
How's Broken Age?
Yeah, how is Broken Age?
Amazing.
Tim Schafer still has it?
He does, yeah, but, well, I don't want to jump straight into criticism, but I would...
Why not? We always do.
But I will.
Okay.
I mean, he had his whole behind-the-scenes thing, and I think after watching them, it makes sense, but it was way too streamlined. It's one-button interaction. The puzzles were really easy. I felt like it's trying to cater for too many people and trying to whitewash too many of the adventure game kind of problems that keep, well, you know, problems in finger quotes that keep getting thrown around. And I don't know. It was a little bit too easy, but it's absolutely beautiful and the characters and writing are great. So,
well, that's good.
A big thing that gets me with a lot of recent adventures is people become really apologetic about the strength of the adventure engine, which is like sort of walking around and exploring an environment. People are really sorry about that, and they go, "Oh no, we won't give you any of that. Don't worry, we won't waste any of your time. We'll let you solve the puzzles instantly," which it ruins a lot for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but otherwise, you think it's a good effort?
No, it is. Yeah, it's like his old games on super easy mode, basically.
Okay. Full throttle without the motorcycle fighting bit in the Demolition Derby. Because that was a pretty easy game. Full throttle's not a hard game.
Yeah, but, you know, I miss the verb coin, though. Like, I don't so much mind when it's just two options, but Full Throttle had, like, licking for crying out loud. I want to lick things.
You want to kick things. You want to do all that stuff.
Yes, and kick, yeah. I want to do all of that. I don't want this one button.
Okay. Kick and lick. That's the way. I don't know. Okay. I saw Tim Schafer on a thing on YouTube. He was doing a live stream of, like, a half an hour of Broken Age, and he was talking about that, about how whenever he talks to people about the adventure games that they got stuck on, his games that they got stuck on, he says that they always talk about the junkyard in Full Throttle and the signpost puzzle in Grim Fandango. So he wanted to avoid having any puzzles that were really difficult that would get people stuck.
What about the Meat Circus? That's notorious.
Yeah, but that's not a point-and-click adventure game.
I know, but people still got stuck on it. And he was never apologetic for that. He just told people off for sucking at games.
Yeah, exactly. You can get away with a lot more in a platformer. I had no problem with the Meat Circus.
Well, it's a pretty notorious spot in the game,
I guess. I've never really had trouble with it. But then again, I'm awesome, so take that, everybody. Yes.
Take that, Tim Schafer opponents.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, yes.
Anything else, Dane? Anything else you've been playing?
No, I've been boring. Banner Saga.
Oh, how's Banner Saga? Man, Banner Saga's been very topical in the news lately.
Yeah, it really has.
Yes, it has. For all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Are you gonna trademark the word Anna? Or Quest? You can trademark Quest, see how that goes.
I was actually, when this whole thing came up, I was like, thank God that Sierra's not jumping in this somewhere, despite the fact they're not really around. They're coming out of the woodworks, claiming that Quest is theirs.
Well, yeah, that'd be a questionable claim.
So would Saga, you'd think.
Yeah, well, Sagas have been around for a lot longer than Candy Crush Saga.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's just steal every word for ourselves.
Yeah.
Good. So, Francisco, what have you been playing lately?
I've been playing The Inner World.
Good.
In fact,
Dane, have you played The Inner World?
I bought it and I installed it and I fell in love with the trailer and I haven't opened it after
what
doing
what is
those
wrong
steps.
With you?
I don't know. I keep seeing the little happy face on my desktop.
I'm going to tell you right now, and I'm not afraid of my threats, so I'm going to do this live on the podcast. Play The Inner World or I'll come and break another one of your blinds.
Oh my god.
I'm putting my foot down right now. Anyway, Francis,
yeah,
how did you find The Inner
World? What happened? I saw the...
You should do it. You should play it.
I really enjoyed it. You very generously gave me The Inner World for... Christmas. I don't remember. You've given me so many Merry games Christmas. Lately for Christmas and for my birthday. You gave me like 6 games. But I think The Inner World was one of them. Yes, the was for Christmas. Anyway, I really liked it. We had a little discussion on our podcast before about how you called me out for being an animation snob. And you were like, well, if the animation isn't like in Curse of Monkey Island, you're going to hate it because The Inner World is not like that. But you know what? I really liked it. And I really liked how The Inner World had... specific little close-up animations for pretty much every action. And yeah, it looked like they were done in Flash, but it was really done well. And and the story was really interesting because like I said in the last podcast, it seems like a kiddie story, but it actually is very it has very dark undertones and it's very much not a kiddie story. It actually deals with some pretty interesting themes. And the puzzles are...
It still retains its heart throughout all of that,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, exactly. And the puzzles are pretty logical and straightforward. I'll admit, towards the end, it was getting on close to 4 in the morning this morning, and rather than just quitting and coming back to it, I wanted to finish it in that one sitting. So there were a couple of bits where I had to consult the in-game hint system to kind of get a nudge in the right direction. But overall, I thought the puzzles were fair and logical, and I really enjoyed it.
I thought the puzzles were great. I've seen people picking on the puzzles, and I don't understand why, because I solved it a little bit each night. I didn't play it all in one sitting. I just played it as I went, and I thought the puzzles were spot on.
Yeah, I played it in, 2 sittings, I guess. Yeah. I played for about 35 minutes the first time, and then however long I have on Steam after that. Probably like 3 hours. But yeah, it was good. What have you been playing, Ben?
Me? I've been playing
as though
games.
I didn't know.
I just started playing for the very first time, much to your delight, King's Quest V by Robert A. Williams.
Yep.
and I have to say I'm really enjoying it. I take back everything I've said about Roberta. I mean, I can totally see the design flaws, and I can see why people would be upset at it, but I've been saving... my game, like CIA paranoid, and you know, and just I think it really rewards the idea of just walking around and finding new stuff, you know.
I disagree.
I mean, well, just because you get killed,
you went into the inn.
but as long as you're aware of you know, the fact that you need to save your game a lot, I think it's fairer than say my old nemesis Leisure Suit Larry 2, which I know I talk about it a lot, but it just some of the stuff is just in that. Whereas King's Quest V hasn't really gotten me to the point where I just look at it and just go, oh, this is just ridiculous. So we'll see how it goes. I'm only 1/10 of the way through the game. I've got 26 of 360 points, so I got some learning to do yet.
There's still a couple of delightful experiences for you to have. Quite a lot of delightful experiences, actually. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what your reaction is to some of them.
For now, I say I'm probably going to go a little bit lighter on Roberta because of, you know, the fact that I'm playing this and I'm enjoying it a lot more than King's Quest, which is the other King's Quest game that I've played. So, you know, I can see the joy in this experience so far. I may end up hating it. I don't know. We'll see. I've also been replaying Deus Ex, the original game from 2001, I think, and because I've been starting work on a cyberpunk game, I've finished my work on Blackwell, so I've started work on another game, and I like to get a bit of inspiration. I'm actually up to LaGuardia Airport, which is funny because a friend of the podcast, Chris Olsen, actually a commercial pilot that flies to LaGuardia. Yes. So there's a tentative connection, if ever there was one.
Absolutely.
A tenuous link to the real world for the AGS podcast. But yes. Yeah, I really I really enjoy the early stages of Deus Ex, especially. I can't wait to get to Hong Kong. I had a friend who hated the Hong Kong area, and I love Hong Kong. So screw you, Jeremiah Busniak. That's all I can say.
He was a bullfrog, wasn't he?
Actually, that was his nickname.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
What we all used to call him.
I know. I know about Jeremiah. You've told me about him.
I tell you everything.
Of course you tell me everything.
I also played an old point-and-click adventure called Beavis and Butthead Do You. I played it last night, and I really enjoyed it. You heard me stay up all night giggling away at it, so that was a great game.
That worries me.
Yeah.
Do you?
The Windows 98 era was a great time for multimedia-related experiences, and that's the second Windows Beavis and Butthead point-and-click adventure, and it's not as good as the first, which is Virtual Stupidity, but it's still pretty great, and I laughed a lot all the way to the end. Anyway, good. That's me.
I had no idea there was two of them.
There's two. Which one have you played, Dane?
Virtual Stupidity.
Oh, man, you're missing out on the high-res one.
Yeah, Do You actually looks like the cartoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that get by me?
I don't know.
It didn't have very much fanfare.
Next time I come and visit, I'll bring it and you can play it. Why are you laughing? You're like, you're never coming to my house again, my blood.
So yeah, that's a good one.
You tricked me into drinking thick shakes again.
Yeah.
But without Ben,
anyway,
how will you get home?
Let's talk about
the bus.
Important game design things which our listeners are very, very, very interested in.
Yeah. Good idea.
Let's do it.
Let's talk about art.
Okay.
So art's nice, isn't it?
Art is nice. Art's a nice thing. Dane, you are well known for your high res style, a nice cartoony look, a very clean look. What inspired you? What sort of games or cartoons or anything like that? What made you think this is how I want to draw my games?
Most definitely Curse of Monkey Island.
I thought
Yeah.
I
can get behind that.
I always loved the LucasArts style more than Sierra's, even when I was younger. So I think I just always kind of gravitated towards that cartoony look. And Curse was just kind of like the epitome of that at its best in my mind.
You didn't want to try and emulate King's Quest 7?
Oh, the Disney King's Quest.
Yeah.
To
Francisco, be like,
Or as I like to call games from that era.
Yeah. No, I remember getting that because of seeing the screenshots and purely wanting to have more of that high-res, but no, it didn't leave much of an impression on me at the time, no. I remember that, seeing that intro and her bursting out into terrible song, and I was like, what is this?
I like to call those games from that era, like King's Quest VII and Torrent's Passage and Leisure Suit Larry VII. That's Sierra's MS Paint era. Because all the sprites just look like they were done in two-tone MS Paint colors, and yeah.
You know what was it?
Space Quest 6, the sprites were a lot smaller, so it wasn't really that obvious, but yeah. They had a lot of black outlines in their sprites, but the other ones just, they threw outlines out the window and just did, oh, here's a one skin tone, here's the other colored in skin tone. We could do this in MS Paint.
I do have a lot of love for the animation in Leisure Suit Larry 7, though.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Leisure Suit Larry 7 is probably the best animated of those era games, but
yeah.
It's still, yeah. And plus the backgrounds are nice, because, I mean, Torrent's Passage had sort of these weird pre-rendered 3D things happening mixed with 2D, and King's Quest 7 was nice, but yeah, just a terrible game.
Man.
Yeah.
I'll defend King's Quest now that I've started enjoying King's Quest V.
King's Quest, the thing about King's Quest is that as a series, you can't defend it as a series. You have to defend it by individual games.
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
All right.
Because there's some good ones, there's some great ones, and there's some awful ones. So, I mean, in King's Quest VII, you have to cry as part of lots of puzzles. That's your weapon.
I see.
I'd happily bash 7, but I was going to chime in before. I love 5. I'm not sure why, but I do love it.
Yes. So far, team Ben and Dane 1, team Francisco 0. I like this. I like this trend.
I don't have a teammate.
Oh, you got Milton.
I've straight up ripped off a whole chunk of 5. You know when you go in and you see the whole warning sign for the witch's house? And if you go too early, it's kind of like it's a bit dangerous and you shouldn't be there. I've taken that straight out into Anna's Quest.
Nice.
You've got a witch, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
No, it's pretty much like... It's pretty shameful, actually. It's in a woods. It's got a warning sign. It's pretty much exactly as it is in King's Quest V.
It's okay.
I love it so much.
I ripped off the background, sort of, for where the Weeping Willow is. I totally referenced that in Ben Jordan 6. And I also ripped off the catacombs in King's Quest VI in Ben Jordan 6. Like, not even trying to disguise it at all. So
yeah, you did.
But King's Quest V has a soft spot in my heart because it was the first King's Quest game I played on the NES. So, yeah.
That's the system you want to play it on.
Oh, yeah.
If anything.
Are you kidding
that
me?
That has enough colors to do it justice.
Man, have you seen the screenshots? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's different.
Give him credit for doing such a big game on an NES cartridge and actually managing to replicate more or less those backgrounds with just tile sprites.
You know what I have to give credit for is how good your Cedric impression actually is. It's really, really accurate.
I know.
I was sitting through the longest intro ever, which is the introduction to King's Quest V, and going, man, Francisco's Cedric is really, really good. This is like this is making me nostalgic for talking to Francisco. But the funny thing was, is
how can you get nostalgic for talking to me? You talk to me all the time. you were talking to me at the time.
I'm allowed to be short-term nostalgic.
Fair enough.
And it made me laugh because I mimicked Cedric at one point and you couldn't tell over my laptop microphone who it was, which says just how professional the voice acting was in Queen's Quest V.
Yep.
It's pretty hilarious. But no, Queen's Quest V has really, really, really lovely backgrounds.
Yeah, it really does.
Mm.
Yeah, there's some beautiful art in there. I can see why anyone would be inspired to like learn things from them. As you know, I screenshot games as I play them, and I've been taking some of the stuff from King's Quest V, and, you know, the animation isn't spot on compared to, you know, Westwood games or LucasArts games, but, you know, it's a beautiful game, so the more power to it for having, like, being the first Sierra game. It was the first Sierra sort of VGA game, right?
Yep.
Yeah, more power to it for being out there and just having, and I know some people were really like King's Quest IV and were sad with the change from EGA, but I think King's Quest V is really nice. Not that King's Quest IV isn't, because that looks nice as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we should talk more about art, Dane. I remember back in 2011, it was February 2011, because I checked this morning, and you sent me a build of Anna's room, it was at the time, which to test, and I remember you telling me that it was you're going to work on it for your masters, but you didn't actually study art or animation, did you?
No, it was a very vague masters, actually.
What did you study?
I don't even remember. It was some ridiculous title. Hold on.
Media or film or something like that?
Yeah, kind of. It was more like media-centric. I think it was meant to be directed towards like graphic design and things like that, and I just kind of cheated it and just kind of like pummeled it into a shape that I could excuse for game design.
So go on.
No, I was just going to say, I got through it with that excuse.
Yeah, but did you find that a helpful resource for learning to make games, or was that just something that you did and you're like, oh, I want to make games, that's what I'll do?
Yeah, it's weird. Like, when I look back, I don't really remember any... Like, I didn't go into the Masters thinking I was going to do game design, and somewhere along the way, I think it was sitting in the lectures and realizing the only thing I'd written down was sketches. And I kind of, like, the sketches slowly became Anna, but I think my mind just kind of naturally gravitated towards making a game. And at that time, I didn't really know much about AGS, and that was just the time I was starting to discover that whole scene. Like, I played the Blackwell games, and I was kind of curious and figuring out how he did them. And I think it just kind of poking around AGS forums at that point in time and having to find something to do with the Masters just kind of coincided at that right time.
I find it interesting because I don't think we've had anyone on the podcast that has actually like studied art and like successfully like gone through. I know you went to art. You did an art sort of thing in college, Francisco, but you never really did much with it. And I failed art in year 11.
Well, so, it's funny actually. I don't know if I've ever talked in detail about it, but yeah, when I went to college, I started off doing this. The major was called Digital Arts and Sciences, and it was basically doing video game art, I guess. That was kind of everybody's goal. Because there's a school in Orlando called Full Sail University, and that's kind of geared towards, you know, specifically making video games. They have ads in the back of magazines and stuff like that. This was a little bit more of like an infant program to kind of get people, you know, sort of on that track. But it was very, very much in its infancy, so there was no real focus to it. So basically the way it worked was you had to do your first 2 years building up a portfolio and then submit it to be reviewed, and then if you got in, your last 2 years you'd do the digital arts thing. So long story short, there was some confusion on my part as to how long I had, and I kind of had to cobble together a portfolio real quick. And I actually threw in like screens from a game I was working on at the time, which weren't that great. And yeah, I didn't get, my portfolio got rejected, so I became embittered and sad, and I didn't go, and I changed my major to history. So there was that. That was my illustrious 2 years of art school in college.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2001. I think I switched over to history in like fall of 2002, maybe? I don't know. I was in college from 2000 to 2004, so.
Had you done any AGS games by then?
Yes. Did my first AGS game in 2000. Well, yeah, I did, because I remember being a freshman in college working on my AGS games, and that was 2000, 2001. So I think I did my first Reality on the Norm game in like 2001 or so. I know I joined the Reality on the Norm forums before I joined the AGS forums.
Wow, that seems kind of backwards now.
Yeah.
Plus.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I got Yahtzee to do a voice in one of my Reality on the Norm games, so that was kind of cool. Yeah.
There you go, man. See, Yahtzee had left the AGS forums by the time I joined.
Yeah, me too.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So yeah, I think he had just left. But Dan, did you study art at all, or are you just kind of self-taught?
This is you, Dan.
Yes.
Oh, me? I thought you were talking to Ben.
No, I know all about Ben. I don't care about Ben. I care about you.
No. Well, yeah, I think the only actual classes that I took was in my master's, which was for animation.
Okay.
Up until then, I'd just been self-taught, yeah, just from sketches and playing around. I never really did... I never really took drawing that seriously. It was always just like a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point when I was in uni and I was considering doing game design, I wanted to make the most of it and scout out at the electives. And yeah, saw this animation one. And yeah, I have to say, just in that one course, I learned a whole heap. I mean, I'd only ever done, you know, sketches. I'd never really done animation before. Anna's Quest is pretty much... Like the animations that you see in that first bedroom is pretty much my first foray into animation.
Wow, they're beautiful. You did well.
Oh, thank you.
No, they really are. Like, one thing that really stood out to me is how nicely Anna's Quest was animated. So, man, you've got it. It's clear.
Yeah.
Well, I've definitely learned a lot along the way. I would like to go back and start some of those ones now, knowing what I've learned from beginning to game.
Well, that's the artist's curse, really.
Yeah.
I noticed around your computer, Dan, you're like me, you've sort of surrounded yourself with pictures, like screenshots of games and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Do you find it important to like have that visual inspiration around you when you draw?
I don't know if that's so much a visual thing, to be honest, as a storytelling thing. I think that helps me more when I'm writing. I have specific moments in games, maybe stuff like The Dig, which is a bit more atmospheric, that helps with drawing, but things like the Full Throttle picture, where it's that moment when he's taking the photographs to Maureen and she's learning about what happened to her, what is it?
Dad.
Uncle? Dad? Uncle. Yeah. Dad. That,
Uncle was the one with the mink wrench.
Yes, yes, of course, yeah. yeah. Just shaming my knowledge of Full Throttle for everyone.
It's fun.
But,
it's fun.
No, those are the kind of moments that I like to have around. So when I'm writing, it kind of grounds me and reminds me of what I enjoyed when I played those games and helps me to try and recreate those moments, more so than art, actually.
Okay. Do you sort of go looking online for art? Because something I've forced myself to do, even when I really don't feel like it sometimes, I force myself to go and seek out new stuff to look at and be inspired and go, oh, I want to paint like that. I want to, you know, what do they do that I don't do that I can learn and sort of add to my tool set?
Yeah, I make up like mood boards for every setting for sure. I'll go and grab a whole ton of art of people that are kind of getting more or less a mood with colors and lighting and stuff like that and make a huge mood board. So I kind of have that in the background while I'm doing the backgrounds for a certain area. So, yeah, it gets you in that kind of mood, hence mood board. Yeah.
Good mood board. But, yeah, no, I find that, like, Francisco knows because we've been working on a project for a while now. I often collect stylistic references, which may have nothing to do with the game, but have a color scheme that I like or, a color scheme I want to follow when working on the next game. I think that's very much a big thing from the artist. Not to steal ideas blatantly, but be inspired and allow yourself to be affected by someone else's ideas and choices.
Definitely, yeah.
It's really interesting, too, to see other people's color choices and what they, you know, because you have your standard complementary colors and stuff like that, but every now and then people will do something that you don't expect. There'll be a green somewhere you don't expect it, and it can really teach you how to make an image pop in an interesting way if you follow that, I think. So I really like that idea of sort of working on following someone else's art and learning stuff. Do you have a direction you'd like to push your art in the future, Dane, or are you pretty happy where you are?
No, I mean, as you say, I do work very clean. I work in like flats, so like I do clean lines, flat colors, and kind of that's the way I work. But I definitely would want to try to do a more painterly style, very much like yours, Ben.
Thank you. Are there any games around at the moment that you go, oh, man, I wish my game looked like that? Is there anything out there?
Well, it's kind of a little bit, I may as well be saying Curse of Monkey Island because it's very much along that style, but the guys that are doing that Journey of Izar?
Yes.
Oh,
man. And actually,
oh my God.
I know that Daniel actually listens to our podcast, so.
Oh. Well, there you go.
Everything I saw of that guy's in the AGS forums, I was entirely jealous of. If I could choose someone's talent to have, it would be his.
Yeah, he's a really good artist. He's got like a really clean style, but it never looks like just flats. He's always, you know, everything's painted in really nice. Really, I'm always impressed by his color choices. You know, that probably seems like a strange thing to pick on, but anyone that's seen my pictures knows that I'm all about the color choices. So yeah, I really like his choice of color.
Yeah.
So there you go, Daniel. You're an inspiration to us. that's true. There's nothing to be ashamed of, I don't think. You know.
No, true. It's after seeing them, it actually, for a long time, it made me go back and kind of pick up my game a little bit more and reassess my background. So he definitely was a big inspiration at that point.
Absolutely. I remember when Theo sent me the very first build of the Journey Down, and I was pretty confident in my backgrounds at the time, which are awful. You know, they're rubbish backgrounds. If you go and look at Featherweight now, which I was really proud of at the time, it's just it just looks shit. Like it's like the very, very first 5 minute sketch of a background, you know. And I remember he sent me that and I was pretty confident. I took one look at it and went, oh man, I've got some learning to do, you know. If ever I get cocky in my artwork and go, oh man, I can paint good now, I just go and look at someone else's work and 2 seconds later I'm just like, oh, I'm the worst. I have to here comes another 2 years of hard practice. But I think that's a good thing, you know, to be inspired.
You need,
Yeah. You need to kick your ass into gear a little bit and go, oh man, I can do so much better than this. I mean, even for me, you know, because it's kind of hard comparing low res to high res, except in like composition and color choice. But if I go back and play, like, I recently went, and well, not recently, but fairly recently went and played the second Kyrandia game and just went, oh man, these guys are so much better than anything I've done, even like remotely, you know, just, and even like, the animations and stuff like Sam and Max Hit the Road, you just go, there's definitely room for improvement no matter what I've done, you know, no matter how far I've come. It's very humbling and also very inspiring, I think.
Yeah.
I found it very interesting to watch you paint. It's not, or watch you draw, it's not something you get to do very often, is to sit down with someone and watch them hold a pen or a, you know, a tablet pen and watch you draw. You draw very differently to either I or Francisco. I notice it takes you forever to make a line. You're very careful. Like, every line in your background, like, you see one curved line, but that's about 10, like, pen strokes for you.
Yeah, that's not a good habit either, though, really. I should be getting more confident and comfortable with making single strokes and that kind of thing, but I'm just too anal. I'm very pedantic. I have an image of how I want those lines to be, and I can't quite get them in single strokes. It looks too rushed, so I prefer to take my time and whittle it out.
How big do you draw your backgrounds? Do you resize or do you draw original res?
No, they're like 1920 by 1080, doubled, whatever that is. It's like 4,000 something by something or other.
3,840?
Something. I'm not even going to attempt to do math.
2,160.
Spoken like sure. A true artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about technique, because I was very much inspired by Curse of Monkey Island myself, and I always wanted to make a game in that style. But I'm not so great in high res, and I attempted to sort of try doing the Curse of Monkey Island style in a game that never got released. And I read about how they had done it in Curse of Monkey Island. I think it was Bill Tiller had done like a thumbnail sketch, and then he would scan the thumbnail sketch and blow it up and then print it out and then color over it with, or paint over it with a pen to get the nice clean black lines, and then scan it again and then color it in Photoshop or whatever, and then descale it down to 256 colors, and yeah, it just seemed like so tedious and so ridiculous. And then when I tried it, I drew my backgrounds, and I did this for Ben Jordan 8 also. I drew the backgrounds on a piece of paper. I just did the line art, and then I scanned them in, or ghetto scanned as I call them, because I didn't have a scanner at the time. I took pictures of them, and so I'd have the line, and then I'd kind of just put that in Photoshop as a layer, and then color and shade underneath, and then resize. So I didn't get a chance to see you working, but do you just draw straight on the tablet? You don't do anything on paper?
Yeah, no. Well, originally I did, and I just kind of, as you said, I got a bit sick of the process more than anything. And along the way, I got more comfortable with the tablet. But I used to do something similar to that. I wouldn't ink my lines, like, I wouldn't go to that extent. But I did used to sketch things out. I even used to do my first few animations, because I was doing the animation course. I would do it in pencil under, like, a light box and scan that in and then do it that way. But, way too much work.
Yeah, I tried doing that too, and this was like back with, I think I was using PaintShop Pro, and I actually had to go in and paint out the little jaggies that would form when I would put the background, the pink sort of transparent color in the back. I had to go, oh man, I wasted so much time on that, and then I never released anything. So yeah, I guess that's why I got frustrated. But anyway, please go on. Tell us more about your technique.
Well, I was just going to say, though, I mean, it's two different ways of thinking, right? I mean, I haven't ever put that much effort into kind of pixel art, like that lower res stuff, but whenever I've sat down to try it, I've obviously had the wrong approach. I'm still thinking in lines, whereas, you know, it doesn't quite work. Everything's just, you have to kind of have a painterly approach with that lower res background stuff, right?
I think to an extent, it depends on the style you're going for. Yeah. You know, I've worked in lines in pixel art. You know, if you look at some of my earlier stuff, you can see the lines there. If you look at some of the, I want to say Super Jazz Man, you know, I can appreciate that he used a lot of colors in very clever ways there, but you can still see lines, you know. And I know Super Jazz Man is a pretty obscure thing to reference, but it's a great game, so everyone should. I don't know if you can even buy it anymore.
Hmm.
I don't know. I remember it being a 3 megabyte download, which was amazing for me because I was on a 56K modem at the time still, which is, ridiculously outdated. I was on terrible internet for a long time. I've always been like 10 steps behind when it comes to the internet.
You were on terrible internet for like the first half of our podcasts. So
yeah, I was. But man, I remember downloading the second Apprentice game and having like, you know, this was a long time ago, and being like, man, this computer cannot be touched for a day while this downloads. these days you download something and it's like, you know, who cares? Someone asked me the other day, someone asked me about the file size. I'm like, oh man, I'm worried that this game I'm working on is going to be too big. I said, how big is it going to be? They said, oh, 500 megabytes. I said, nobody cares about 500 megabytes. People will watch like a HD trailer for a game that's 500 megabytes and not care about it. You know, so yeah, but anyway, I'm getting distracted. But there's an interesting thing that we talked about in terms of like we were talking about Bill Tiller doing the line work and then doing the thumbnail, scanning it in, printing it out, doing the line work, scanning it in, painting it, reducing the colors, and then putting it in game. It's amazing to me. I always think about how small teams can be now in terms of, you know, how many people can be on an art team and make all of the graphics for a full-size game, because you've got this sort of technology that's so enabling now. You know, you've got, I look at what you do, you know, you've got this pen tablet and, you know, and it's a fairly entry-level stuff that we use. You know, you and I both use the Wacom tablet, but we don't have like a Cintiq or anything like that. We don't have big fancy tablets. It's just a basic thing. And Photoshop, I mean, I use Photoshop Elements, which is like a $100 program. It's the most, I think it's very empowering technologically what we can do. And, you know, obviously you're very heavily reliant on alpha channels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Could you see yourself doing it like the pen and paper way?
No. It's too, as you said, it's too, even with these things, like you kind of sell them a bit short, saying that they're not, I can't remember how you describe them, but they're pretty powerful for what they are. Like it's
cheap and powerful. By entry level, I'm talking more about price point, because my painting software and my painting hardware in total is worth about $200, which is nothing. Yeah. You know? And you can do it on a laptop.
I've got a $40 Wacom tablet that I bought about 7 years ago. And I use Photoshop 6.0, so...
Which you paid a lot of money for, the
end. Yes, I did. Goodbye. So, really, it's really not... And, man, I've taken pictures of backgrounds on my phone, with my iPhone camera. And it's pretty, you know, it comes out pretty high res sometimes.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
it amazes me now. And even, like, the tools that we use for, like, making music... making, like, coding the game itself. We've got stuff like, I mean, you use Vision Air now. How is Vision Air to use, by the way?
I have to confess, I'm doing very little of the programming. It looks, from the little toying that I have had the chance to do with it, it's actually got a lot of similarities to AGS. Apart from some of the bad English that's in it, I probably could mistake it for AGS a lot of the time, to be honest.
Okay. But yeah, it really impresses me like how like viable it is to sit in your underwear at home and like make a game by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, underwear is not a requirement. I just like to put that out there. We do support the use of clothing while making games, but we're very much of the idea that it's non-optional.
Oh, I thought you were going to go the opposite way and say that underwear was optional, that you could just program your games naked. I find creativity comes to me a lot better if I'm not wearing any clothing. That's why I get all my best ideas in the shower.
Mm. I won't deny that I paint, you know, without the need to feel dressed. I won't deny that. Good. But yeah, no, I think it's very much, it's a very cool thing, you know, and yeah, it's just, it used to be like artists would take their sketchbook everywhere and stuff like, and you know, you do your sketches. Now you can have like a tablet in your hand and you just draw on that and you can save that and save it to your Dropbox or whatever, and you've got that all the time. It's kind of crazy how empowered we've become over the last 10 years.
That kind of takes the romance out of it though, doesn't it? I mean, it's not quite the same if, you know, a pretty lady comes to you in the park and she's like, oh, that's so nice, and you're like, would you like to come back and see my etchings, as opposed to like,
man,
hey, you want to see my tablet? And yes, I know, I just did my generic female voice, I know. Relax.
That was a very seductive scenario you just painted there. Nobody has ever said to me, oh, what are you drawing? You know, that's never been a gateway to anything more.
Oh, well. You got to go to the right parks, man.
Man, why would I go and draw in a park? I can draw in my underwear at home. I can draw in the underwear at the park.
Yeah, you can go and draw in your underwear. Oh, there's crazy old Ben in his underwear again, drawing in the park.
Hey,
kids!
I'm drawing my picture.
Oh, man, you know who does do that in the park and who lives in Brisbane? You can go see him, Dane. It's Picasso.
Picasso, yes. But he doesn't just paint with one tool. He also uses his butt cheeks to, like, to block out his things. So
well,
there's
good
that.
Good for him. Yeah. Good for him.
I actually mentioned visiting Picasso when we went to Brisbane, but Francisco,
so did I. I thought I was the one that mentioned going to visit him.
You mentioned Picasso, but I mentioned going to visit him, and you weren't very much for it.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Man, what a stick in the mud I am.
What's that, sorry?
I said, what a stick in the mud I am.
Yeah, you are.
Oh.
You are.
I'm sure if I had had a few more glasses of Pig's Arse, I would have been happy to go visit Picasso. By the way,
I don't think you could
listeners...
handle any more glasses of Pig's Arse.
No, I couldn't. By the way, listeners, do not, under any circumstances, Google image search for Picasso, because you will
if you've done that before, like, if you've done that already in the brief times that's lapsed since we mentioned Picasso, we would like to hereby issue a formal apology.
I don't want it. You know what you were getting into. I'm not apologizing for shit.
Fair enough. You deserve every mental image and actual image that you just got. So
exactly.
There.
Yes. Anyway, moving away from
penises.
Yeah, which we always inevitably end up talking about on our podcast.
Somehow.
Yeah, I guess. So yeah, Art. I wanted to also talk about not just technique, but also about Well, I guess I do want to talk about technique, because Dane, we've talked about your high-res style. I want you to shed a little bit of light on your technique, and then I guess I can sort of say mine. So the listeners of our podcast who are kind of confused as to what style they want to go for and what they want to try, maybe they can get some tips.
Okay. Do you want me to talk now?
Well, I asked you, so I mean, okay. It's your prerogative. We can have a moment of silence. I mean, we've never really tried that before.
Okay. I noticed one thing when I went to Dane's house and I used Dane's tablet, and I've noticed when I watch you paint is that everyone sets their tablet up differently. I like a really liquid sort of feel to my tablet. I like just the paint to flow. And actually, Dane was kind enough to let me draw on his computer, because I'd been sort of 2.5 weeks without drawing anything.
Yeah.
And I really got the withdrawals, and Dane was kind enough. And not only that, he let me completely reconfigure his Wacom so that I could draw. I hope I didn't like ruin your workflow by doing that, Dane.
No, well, it's easy for me, because I just have to put all the sensitivities up to like 100%, so you only lightly touch it and it does a completely bold line, so it's easy enough to reset my settings.
It's funny, because I was telling Francisco the other day that I was like, we actually did this cool thing where we got Mashed Potato from the India Stone, who works on Project Zomboid. She has worked on AGS stuff in the past, like A Cure for the Common Cold, and a One Room, One Week game that I cannot remember for the life of me.
Hmm.
But that was a cool game as well. And we did a sort of speed painting thing where we gave ourselves an hour and a random theme picked by the random noun generator, and we all just painted a picture in an hour. And I've completely lost where I was going with this, so that's nice. But, you know, actually, one other thing I wanted to do was to put fog in my scene, so I painted stuff on at 1% opacity, And I was like, I sort of thought in my head, I wonder how many people use 1% opacity on their brushes, you know, because it really blew me away when I sort of picked up your tablet and started painting. Everything was just instant, like this instant block of color. And I, oh man, yeah. I can't paint like this. Dane, what are you doing to me? And I was sort of, I've nagged Francisco and finally brought him over to the light side of using opacity on the tablet when you paint, because pressure sensitivity is a wonderful thing.
Mm.
You know, it gives you a lot of power, a lot of control, not just over size, but over, you know, how much paint you're spilling onto your canvas at any one time. It makes it a little bit more like airbrushing. People ask me, like, I've got relatives that paint with oils, basically, and they always say, oh, what's it like painting on the computer? I can't imagine. And I say it's a lot more like airbrushing, because you put on how much you want at a time. It's actually really nothing at all like airbrushing, but that's one way of looking.
Have you ever tried oil painting, Ben?
No, I've only ever tried painting with acrylics.
How about you, Dane?
Yeah, I'm terrible.
Well, it's just a matter of technique. I mean, it's like we've always said, you know, people who are like, oh, I'm going to get a tablet and I'm going to be able to draw amazingly, and then people try it and they get frustrated. When it's just another medium to learn. Oil painting, I mean, I've done acrylic painting, I've done oil painting. I've actually was really into oil painting. I took an observational painting class in college, and it was really interesting, because it really does teach you about mixing colors and blending and stuff like that, and being very careful, because obviously if you make a mistake, you can't just paint over like acrylic. You have to wait for the paint to dry to be able to fix any mistakes. But, I mean, I would compare painting with a tablet on the PC to, I guess, sort of a mix between acrylic and oil, because you can mix your colors and blend them a lot more like oil painting that acrylic doesn't really let you do. But you can paint over mistakes. Well, you also have layers, but if you want to be like Ben, not use layers, you can kind of just fix your mistakes instantly. Or hit Control Z. Like,
not using layers sounds absolutely terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. I feel the same way. I feel absolutely the same way.
I'll be honest, it's funny, you know, though, the first time I started doing it, I was terrified as well. But that was a long time ago. And I soon learned, this is something I was discussing with Ilyich the other day, who's another great artist. You know, he does great work. And I used to be terrified that, like, I'd make a mistake and not be able to fix it. But I got to the point where I'd spend so long adjusting something on a layer that I'd done wrong, that it would have been quicker to repaint it from the beginning anyway, you know. And I think as long as you make sure, because I start very rough. I start with a very loose thing. I don't start with lines at all. You know, I'm blobs. You've seen me paint, Dane, and you've seen me paint Francisco. I block things out first, and then, you know, I'm like, I admire people like Bob Ross, who just go in and they just paint a picture. You know, they don't sketch it out first. So, you know, even though you think about composition and everything like that, it's all about big blobs and what bits of light look good where. So, yeah, I used to spend more time trying to fix something on a layer than I would have done just to go, all right, that's wrong, paint it again. So, and one thing I always find is if you paint a picture and it looks totally wrong and you start again, you're always quicker the second time, because you know now what you want to do, which seems kind of weird. But, yeah, so that holds no fear from me anymore. I nearly used a layer the other day. So that was something. I was like, oh, man, I'm nearly using a layer for something. But no, I didn't end up doing that. I was like, oh, screw it. I'll just paint it straight on.
You know what's really fun? No, what's really fun is if you go and you try and paint in acrylics or oils after you're used to using Photoshop to paint, and you're just like, subconsciously, you're just like, oh man, I screwed up. Oh, Control Z. Oh, wait a minute. There is no undo button in real life. Oh, wait, I can't use layers.
I'm painting on the wrong layer. Painting on the
wrong layer. Oh, wait a minute.
But yeah, so it still terrifies me a little bit to think that I'm not using layers, but I really felt it was holding me back. You know, I felt my fear of painting on one thing was holding me back in terms of, like, what I'd do, what I'd be comfortable doing. And now I just do any old thing. If it's wrong, I start again. So
no, I think after watching you, like, because I talked a lot to you about the idea of trying to learn more about painting and that kind of technique, and I think after watching you and talking to you about it, when I do start to try that style a bit more, I'll definitely have to push myself out of that comfort zone to do the one layer thing. Otherwise, I'll probably never pick up on a lot of the things that I need to for it.
I like, as you know, I like using really soft brushes, really low. And I don't mean like really soft brushes, like where you just paint a shape in with a really soft brush, because that looks stupid. It doesn't look stupid, but you lose a lot of definition and clarity if you do that. I like using hard edge brushes, and then I like finishing pictures up with really soft edge brushes, like with lighting and that, because light bleeds and light spills and light bounces around everywhere. So I like to spread my light out a lot with a really, really, really low opacity, really soft brush. And if you're using that on layers and you've got something in the foreground, sometimes the light doesn't spill onto that like I think it should, and it actually makes a picture look more flat, or makes the layers of a picture, because you paint in layers, you know, when you're doing your composition, you have like foreground, middle ground, background, extra background, you know. And I like the light to spill over everything. I'll actually, someone accused me of making light move in unrealistic ways, and I said, well, I'd rather something looks good to me than to look realistic, which is a ridiculous thing to say, because realism is, you know, the ultimate goal. But
yeah. That's true. I think when you think too much about lighting, you can kind of not get the full potential. A lot of times I'll see an interesting background, and when you do really stop and think about where the light sources are coming from, they don't always make a lot of sense. But as you say, if they get an interesting look, then you've succeeded anyway.
Yeah, I think you look at movies all the time. You look at films and how things are lit in films. Films have that many different light setups and that many different sort of, you know, you've got an ambient light and you've got a background light, and then you've got a light that's provided just to give rim light to someone's face. They're really nice to look at. And then when, if you just look at a normal piece of footage that's just shot on a normal camera with no normal lighting, it looks terrible, you know. You get so used to seeing stuff that's lit by lighting technicians and a director that says, right, I want this here and that there, that it's important to construct your lighting for a scene, not just to go, oh, this is how it would look in a photograph.
Yeah.
So,
but before I kind of lose my thought on it, I wanted to ask you, because a lot of your own games, Ben, have been very like the backgrounds have had a very kind of unrefined, surrealistic kind of look. But the latest Blackwell one with the screenshots, it's probably like, I would say it looks like your most refined kind of background.
Yeah, learning to work in a style that would suit the Blackwell series was very interesting for me, because Blackwell stuff in the past looks nothing at all like anything I'd ever drawn, you know? I mean, there was... So I really had to push myself.
I was going to say, you're talking about the idea of using, you know, big strokes and stuff like that, but you would have really... I imagine you would have done the basis of the backgrounds that way, but then towards the end you would have really gotten in there with a little brush and added lots of detail to it.
Oh, I use the one pixel brush. Yeah, I paint with the smallest brush possible when I'm finishing Blackwell stuff up. It's necessary when you're using such low resolution. But yeah, I was showing Francisco was actually watching me sketch out a painting the other day, and he was kind of, I think he was interested in how messy my brush strokes start, because I'm pretty messy when I'm sketching stuff out. Yeah. I don't make nice, neat lines. I'm a messy guy, you know. I love the freedom of just getting a big old brush and just slapping stuff down, you know. So, yeah, it was hard to learn, but the hardest thing was straight lines, and, you know... I've gotten away with a lot of perspective tricks in the past that just I can't get away with in Blackwell. And there's some really bad perspective issues in Blackwell that if you're not really looking for, you won't notice. But I know that they're there, and I'm like, I think I'll get away with it. That's what
I know exactly. Sorry. What you mean. I have the same demons.
Yeah.
We all do.
Francisco.
I have those demons all very much.
But Francisco knows one of my sayings is, I look at a thing and go, that's off, but I think you'll get away with it, you know. So for me it's about what does something
another
work
one of another one of Ben's classic sayings is, your perspective is fucked. But then again, I'm the worst person to take advice from perspective from, so
I say the same thing about subtlety.
Yes.
I say, man, that's the least subtle thing ever, and that's coming from me. So I know I'm very much aware of my faults, but I look at, you know, I've talked about this before on the podcast and I hate to reiterate, but it bears repeating, is I look at stuff like the Blackwell Convergence and the Blackwell Resonance and Resonance and I look at the tricks of how they played around with perspective, And there's a lot of places where the perspective has been fudged in those. And I go, well, if they can get away with it, and I really like their style, then in certain cases, I think I'll get away with it too. A lot of the times, it's to avoid scaling. You know, if I can avoid scaling, it's not such a big deal at high res, but at low res, scaling often looks terrible. So,
well, plenty of classic games did it too. I mean, I just showed you a screenshot the other day of King's Quest VI. Dane, you've played King's Quest VI, right?
Yeah.
You know the bookstore background that has this great, it's the composition is this great. It's framed by a bookshelf where you have these books in the foreground, and it's like you're peeking through a hole in the bookshelf at the rest of the bookshelf. Yeah. I love that background, but if you look at the perspective of the books in the foreground, they would be going off at like some very strange angle outwards towards, you know, the perspective is totally off, but it works because you're not really. It's kind of a subconscious thing that you have. You're just thinking, okay, this is in the foreground. You're focusing on the background. So they can get away with stuff like that.
Mm.
As I said to Francisco when he showed me the shot, I was like, well, the perspective is totally off. But in this case, it works because the amount of technical sort of correctness that they lose from having perspective off like that is made up for by the fact that they framed the shot really beautifully.
Yeah.
One thing that kind of bothers me is you get like these paint overs someone will ask for help with their background, and the only thing people ever talk about is your perspective's wrong, you know, and they draw lines on the thing and go, this is how your perspective should be. Whereas some of the best backgrounds I've ever seen have got wrong perspective. It's an important technical thing to know how to do, but it's not the only thing you should focus on. You should talk about, like, colours and stuff like that. Like, there's perspective in Day of the Tentacle. Francisco tried to tell me it was correct perspective the other day. It's not correct perspective. It's awful perspective, but that works, you know?
That's the point I was just going to make. When you get those kind of LucasArts, the Curse does it as well, the Curse of Monkey Island, where things will curve towards the camera. And because it does that, you don't have those straight lines. It throws your whole sense of what's kind of proper perspective, and you just get away with so much more when you do all of that cartoony perspective.
Yeah. Well, I was just analyzing the backgrounds in the Inner World last night, and like the throne room at the end has crazy wrong perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh man, really? And you know, most of the backgrounds towards the end, and well, throughout the whole game, have just crazy perspective, and I'm just like, eh, but it works.
That's right. Yeah. I think. It's not so much about doing correct perspective. Well, I look at the Journey Down. There's some stuff where he's got really, really rigid perspective, and it's just perfect two-point perspective, really strong. And there's other places where he bends the entire world, like he curves it backwards to how it should curve, and he gets away with it perfectly because the guy's got a great sense of what he can get away with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and here's another thing that I've often thought is, the real world is not all in straight lines. Roads curve, you know, things are built on curves, things are built on slopes, things are built around corners. Stuff isn't always perfectly straight, you know. People say about, like, the houses that have got sagging roofs, you know, and they look wrong. I've seen houses that look like that. You can get away with that stuff as long as you do it, you know, neatly and don't overuse it.
Yeah, so well... One thing that I've never, I still don't feel completely confident about is that the idea of breaking things up into thirds, I think that ends up becoming more important than perspective. If you get the right balance of where you're trying to drag the eye, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
When that's not working, even if your perspective's right, but there's things not in the right thirds and your eye's getting taken to the wrong places, that throws me off a lot more than perspective does, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. A lot of the times you get a scene that just doesn't read well because of that, or it's been poorly framed.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that I'm trying to improve myself.
Do you know something I've noticed?
What?
Sorry, you go on.
I was just going to say, I find it hard to start with a blank page and figure out where you want those points of attention to be. It's not until you kind of get through so far through your background that you start thinking, oh, there's too much attention up here and there's too much empty space there, and you start trying to fill it in with detail.
Yeah. I often try and highlight things with lighting and color, you know, like I'll sort of do a sort of spotlight on where I want the eye to be drawn, because I find light is a nice way of sort of focusing, like in sort of theater where you'll have a spotlight on the main actor, so your eye's always drawn to that sort of that spot.
Yeah.
I'll very focus on getting a shot lit so that everything's where I need it to be, you know. And sometimes Dave has had to say, oh, this light's too distracting in this spot, you know, where I've tried to do something clever like that, so I'll have to move it. But, you know, most of the time, I think lighting helps a lot. But as you said, designing in thirds is an interesting one because I don't like to perfectly design in thirds. In fact, the other day I did a painting with the focal point right in the very middle just to see if I could get away with it because I think it's like... That's something I've been playing around with a lot lately because there was a long time where I hated like the one-point perspective where you put everything right in the middle and everything like that. But I've tried to vary things up and see if I can get away with it a bit more now. And it's hard to get away with one-point perspective and like a focal point right in the very middle, but I think it's possible. Yeah. I think it's doable. You know, I may be wrong. But yeah, one thing I've noticed that's really weird is I'll look through several of my backgrounds all at once and like I put them on top of each other and compare them, and often I put things in the same spot unconsciously. Like I'll have a foreground object that's always in the exact same spot. Like, yeah. And I think it's just instinct. You just get this habit of putting stuff in certain positions. But there's certain backgrounds of mine that I can overlay of each other. And I go, man, how did I get that door like 2 pixels off from the other door? It's just I don't even know how it happens. It's just something I'm unconsciously doing. But that's kind of freaked me out. It kind of made me worried that I'm painting the exact same scene every time with different colors, you know.
Well, I've never tried that before. I should try that and see. I should
find two of my backgrounds that line up worryingly close and show you, just to give you an idea of how, you know, of how deceptively sort of similar you can trick yourself into painting two scenes. Yeah. And I think it's stuff like that. I think you need to actively think, like, you know, what can I do next? Mm. What can I change? I've been watching a lot of films lately because that's been my kind of New Year's resolution, is to start watching films. And I really, really have been looking at the camera shots and go, what are they doing there that I can use? That's why I watch animated films, is to watch, you know, see backgrounds and see points of view and what tricks I can take, you know. I'm very much a big open sponge when it comes to design. Have you got a film to recommend me, Dane? I watched Children of Men, by the way. It was great. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah. That's an amazing film.
It is.
Recommend me a film. Everyone else has.
You can't put me on the spot like that. I studied film, remember? Yeah, I am. And it's like too many to think of. I can't narrow down on something.
Recommend me something really, really obscure.
Oh, obscure.
That no one else will have recommended, because I've got a lot of recommendations, believe me.
Okay, for something obscure, probably the most obscure that I always recommend people, there was a little Estonian film I saw at a film festival called Autumn Ball, and it's amazing. It's really good, and I wouldn't have seen it if I didn't, on the off chance, go with some friends to this film festival, and it was almost impossible to get on DVD, but it's good if you can track it down.
I'll have a look. I've got eBay. eBay's pretty good. I'll have a look. It's interesting because I think the guy that we worked on with Black Pearl Deception in Creator comes from Estonia. So there's a tenuous link.
Oh, there you go.
Another one. Good.
I like tenuous. Good. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I'll see if I can track it down and watch it.
Yeah.
But as hearing you guys talk about like where the eye goes and all this stuff, I'm just like, man, I just kind of throw up a background and there it is. It's pretty obvious, no. Though. I mean, I usually just like... the thing was, when I was watching Ben sketch, just using blacks on white just to sketch out with, you know, do like a value scale, a value study of the background, I was just in awe because I can't... I tried doing it, but I haven't gotten comfortable with doing it yet. I mean... I don't mind, you know, my shading in black and white is something that I've learned recently and gotten really comfortable with as far as doing like character portraits, because I've kind of done a new style for doing character portraits that I'm actually pretty happy with at this point. But I've kind of, you know, I feel more comfortable just sketching out a scene first, just to kind of get an idea of the composition. And then I kind of start, I don't block it out. I just put in big blobs of... Well, I do block it out, but I don't do painterly blobs of color. I do very rigid walls and you know, color, single colors, and then I go in and do basically the details, and I leave the lighting until almost the end, until it's a scene, unless it's a scene that where I feel that the lighting is going to be really important because it's going to be dramatic lighting or something. I was asking you the other day, Ben, about whether you do your light sources early or later on, because I was actually painting the very first night scene. I haven't painted a night scene in ages. I mean, all my backgrounds for A Golden Wake have been daytime scenes, bright and sunny daytime scenes or indoor stuff. So I was really happy to work on a night scene. And I, for that one, I had to define the light sources pretty early on because I figured, well, you know, it's going to be pretty important how the light's going to work. And yeah, I was pretty pleased with the final result. And then, yeah, so, but yeah, I don't really, I want to kind of push myself out of my comfort zone and try and get something kind of blocked out beforehand. But then there's also the whole underpainting thing, like the sketch that Ben was talking about. He sent me a copy of Work in Progress, and he showed me a little bit of like how the colors, how he was laying out the colors. And I went in Photoshop and I tried using a very, very soft, very very transparent, low opacity brush. And I just, I mean, I kind of got similar results, but I just couldn't really wrap my head around how to get it looking good. So that's an area that I feel that I need to work on.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel you on the nighttime lighting. I had a lot of difficulty transitioning from one chapter in Anna's Quest to another where it was all indoor lighting to outdoor forest nighttime. I even sent that scene to you, Ben, and when I was having trouble lighting, I did it all flat colors and then tried to do adjustment layers over the top of that to get the right look, and it was just terrible. I had the completely wrong workflow with it. I should have been thinking about light way before that point.
Yeah, and another problem I have too that Ben pointed out is color. Since I'm so used to doing, you know, all these bright, colorful backgrounds, there's no color it really in night things. So I made things a little too saturated. So I had to go in and desaturate a few things to make them not look like some sort of crazy neon party.
Yeah, you had the kind of glowing gingerbread bricks going on, which is, yeah, you know, after painting however many sort of day scenes is understandable. I remember your night scene, Dane, I remember you showing me the sort of the scene that you want it to look like, and just the beauty of Photoshop is you can go in after you've finished the painting and just go, right, I want to color everything blue and green. But and I remember, I think I did I do an edit for you?
You did, yeah, just a really,
I think I sent you a crappy PSD or something showing just some basic ideas of you know, but I've really tried to move away from the overlay layer. And from the adjustment layer, because I found it's really starting to hold me back. And yeah, I'm actually, this is kind of weird, but I'm always really reluctant to show people how to use an overlay layer, because I found it held me back, and it still holds me back, you know, where I'd be very lazy and go, oh, I can fix that later with an overlay layer.
No, so, I agree. I ended up trying to fix the night scene with 100 layers, but it just wasn't going anywhere. I had to go back and change the colors from the ground up.
Yeah, that's something that I've been very, very guilty of, and I've used it basically as a crutch, and it's been holding me back, and I'm really trying to pull away from that now, so we'll see how good I go.
You mean it's like an overlay layer where you just kind of like, you know, fill the whole background and put the overlay layer and adjust it to kind of do that, make it look like, you know, like they do in films where they film during the day and then just kind of put a hue over it to make it look like it's nighttime?
Yeah, like that's that? That's pretty much what I was trying to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's quite doable, but you know that you can notice when you look at the background.
Well, Ben, you haven't played it, but Dane, have you played Freddy Farkas?
A little bit. When I was younger, I had the demo.
Okay. Well, Freddy Farkas, I mean, it's understandable why they did it, because obviously to redo all of the town backgrounds. Because, I mean, the town is... The whole game is pretty much set in the one town, and it's got a whole bunch of screens, and there's a sequence at night. So what they did was they just put a blue hue overlay sort of thing over it. And it looks bad. I mean, it doesn't look natural. But to have gone back and done a night version of all of those scenes, I think would have been very expensive and added a lot to production time. So
absolutely.
But I mean, it is a bit jarring when you have, you know, essentially daytime lighting, but with a blue hue over it, and then you have like glowing orange windows.
I've just looked up a screenshot of it. It's pretty cute, actually.
Yeah. So
it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of, you do get that, you will have designers at some point saying, look, I need this scene to have the light on and the light off. That's definitely a thing. And you have to decide how you want to do that. You know, are you going to recolor everything, or are you going to just go, shortcut? You know, I guess it depends on how much time you have and how'd you do it for support grid? That was totally just adjustment layers.
Okay.
Well, probably some overlay layers as well.
Mm.
But yeah, a lot of the rooms in Sepulchre were just slight edits. You know, that was one thing nice about doing a train game.
Yeah.
I remember when I read the script and there was just basically, we're going to need 3 backgrounds, but have edits done to them, basically, which is true, and some close-ups.
Sure.
So yeah, that was interesting. Mm. One thing you kind of get good at doing, like, design work and stuff on games, like, you know, I've been working on iOS ports of stuff, and, you know, just general production graphics. You get used to just fixing the stuff in Photoshop, and you kind of end up using that stuff in your backgrounds as well, you know. Mm. I mean, I look at Resonance, there's that much Photoshop trickery in that, but it all turns out looking good, you know, so... Mm-hmm. It's definitely a tool that you can add to your arsenal and be empowered by. But yeah, I just adjustment layer, click, I'm done. You know, life's good, life's easy. But I remember watching Joshua Nuremberger when he was making Gemini Rue, and he just had this really basic sketch of a scene, and he just had basically done a purple and white value study for it, not black and white, but purple and white, and Luminous came in and just put a curves layer over it. And I know, you know, a curves layer is a pretty powerful tool, but all he did was push the highlights to a more orange sort of thing and push the shadows to a more blue, and instantly the scene popped, you know. Yeah. So a simple adjustment like a curve layer can take something from looking pretty okay to just sensational, just because you're focusing your colors, you know, and not relying on sort of trees are green, trunks are brown, skies are blue, apples are red.
One trick that I've been using in all my backgrounds that you actually taught me, Ben, was, because it's pretty easy to lose sight of your contrast and your colors when you've been doing something for a while and painting a background for a while, is when you're done, try doing auto levels. And sometimes it doesn't do much. Other times it makes a really big dramatic difference. And yeah, just copying it, pasting it over, and kind of making it, lowering the layer opacity so it's just slightly visible and kind of changes your colors a little bit. That can make a world of difference.
Do you know what I think the auto levels does?
What's that?
Because I've been looking at it a fair bit. I think it pushes the darkest color in your image to black and the lightest color in your image to white. And everything else in between gets spread out. I'm pretty sure that's what it does.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure. I mean, yeah, because it makes blues pop out a lot more, I've noticed.
Okay.
Especially, like, yeah, with trees and stuff, it'll make your greens a lot more blue-green. So
I think it probably depends on the color balance in your background.
Yeah, probably.
You use a lot of green when you paint grass and trees, so it probably tries to even that out a bit.
Yeah.
Which is, you know... I'm terrible. This is something that I really suck at, is painting trees green and painting grass green. I'm not good at it. I can't bring myself to do it.
I can't step away from it, so there's my problem.
Everyone's got their weakness. It's something I actually plan on trying, is painting things their actual colors and seeing if I can do it. Because I can't. I'm telling you now, you know, it's not something I'm good at. But I had to paint a couple of day scenes the other day, which is kind of weird because I've had a year of painting night scenes, you know, for the Shiver, for Sepulchre Looking Doors, but for Blackwell and all the good stuff I've been working on. Everything's been night scenes, so all of a sudden I had to paint 2 day scenes, and it was crazy. I was I was ruined, man. I was like, oh, I have to paint everything their actual colors now. And I actually really enjoyed it. It was a great challenge, you know?
Hmm.
So, bring on the day scenes.
So,
I mean, absolutely don't.
So you've been drawing night scenes for the past year. I've been drawing day scenes for the night for the past year. Does that make me the day man and you the night man?
If anybody is the master of karate and friendship for anyone, it is me.
Well, I don't know. I think that I'm the master of karate and friendship for everyone as well.
I think I'm the champion of the sun.
I thought I was the champion of the sun, seeing as though I'm Dayman.
Incorrect.
I don't know. I think you're the one that has to pay the troll toll if you want this boy's hole.
Poor Dave's probably sitting here going, what are these two idiots talking about?
Either that or he's sitting there giggling because he knows exactly what we're talking about.
But he hasn't gone, ah!
That's true, he hasn't.
Which is indicative of him being lost.
Oh well, sorry Dane.
Sorry Dane.
It's alright.
We'll pull the conversation back.
Yes.
What
hello,
were we talking about?
We're talking about adventure games and drawing pictures.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah.
We like this subject. It's a good subject. Have we talked about art much lately? We probably don't think we have.
No, I don't think we've talked about art in a really long time, actually.
Okay, so. Dane, let's talk about your favorite scenes in old adventure games, like backgrounds. What are backgrounds that you look at and go, yes? What's the best part of Curse of Monkey Island visually?
Oof.
Is it the night scenes with the island and the clouds and the moon?
Yeah, so it's funny. My first thought is the first island. I can't even think of what the first island's called, but with those day scenes. But when you get to, it's Blood Island, isn't it?
Yeah. Right.
Those are, I don't know. It's all amazing, Ben.
Okay. I've always been in two minds about Bill Tiller's artwork, you know, so it's kind of, it's interesting for me. I really like his colour choices at night. I really like the green skies. That really always worked for me because it's something different and unique.
I was going to say colours before, I do love his colours everywhere, whether it's day or night.
I love his colour choices with palm tree leaves where he has more purples and yellows than greens and he kind of blends them together.
Okay.
He has purple shadows, which really look nice, and yellow highlights mostly on trees, on tree leaves and palm tree fronds and things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you like one thing that I really like in terms of colors? I think the Dig really stands out for color choices because that game's got every color in the goddamn spectrum. Did I ever link you to the Imgur gallery of all the Dig backgrounds, Dane? Because I know you were looking for them.
No.
Did I ever link to that? Oh, man, remind me to do that.
Do you mean, like, the original painted versions?
Like, the original scenes with no characters on top of them or anything like that. I don't have the original painted versions, but I got the original pixels versions. There's an Imgur gallery of it, and it looks... Man, they're just, like, they used every color known to man. It was just incredible how much... color they used it.
Well, it's like the original Monkey Island 2 before they were scanned with
those
markers.
The originals for that were beautiful.
Yeah, those markers that they used were just like, they were crazy.
It's just a shame that they didn't scale down neatly.
Yeah, well, that was just a byproduct of technology, really, unfortunately. Yeah. But it's interesting because I used to think that they were like Sierra, that they would actually do oil paintings, which, god damn, that's tedious, but I thought that they did oil paintings or watercolors or something and scanned them and scaled them down, but no, they were markers, like magic markers.
They were, yeah,
which is insane to me.
Well, you know, it's just a different technique.
Yeah, it's like I can go out to the 99 cent store and buy a pack of Crayola markers and paint game backgrounds with them.
I will.
Maybe I will. After I finish a Golden Wake, I'll make a little tiny game that's made entirely in markers. It'll be like a Catamites game.
I think you have to be a really good artist to pull off markers really well. I know if I tried, there'd probably be mess everywhere.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah. I've never been able to mess... Have you guys ever been able to do watercolors?
No.
Oh, man, I haven't tried since I was a kid. I used to love playing watercolors as a kid, but it's been a long time.
I've tried it, and I... two things always happen. I always bleed everything everywhere because I put too much water, or I put too much paint and I get everything all gloppy, and it's awful.
Yeah.
I think watercolors are really interesting to me because you don't have a white, so you really have to plan your light spots really early.
Yeah.
You know? So that's something that really interests me.
We used to have this substitute teacher in my high school art class. Her name was Mrs. Dixon. And I'll never forget Mrs. Dixon because she was a watercolor artist. So she always used to want everyone to paint like her. So she would bring in samples. She would always paint like leaves and trees and stuff because she would sell her artwork at this botanical garden thing.
Sure.
So she would always be like, oh, well, this is how you should do this, and blah, blah, blah. And she was very old and opinionated and set in her ways. And then another thing that she would do...
She's like an old female version of me.
Basically. But what she would do, which you don't, thankfully, is she would come around the classroom while we were working, and she would stand behind you, and she would breathe really heavily through her nose and be like... Yeah, so you could hear... She would literally be breathing down your neck while you were painting, and it was like, oh god, go away, Mrs. Dixon. And the best part was, too, she wouldn't just substitute art, she would just substitute everything. So one time I had her for math, and like she would talk about her watercolors in math. We're like, what the hell, Mrs. Dixon, we don't care. We have to learn formulas. And she's like, well, the best formula is mixing your euchre with your ochre with your greens. Or whatever, and we're like, god damn it, Mrs. Dixon, shut up. I hope Mrs. Dixon doesn't listen to this podcast. She's probably dead by now.
Rest in peace, Mrs. Dixon. Rest in peace. We barely knew you. I find it interesting because I'm often sort of, you know, if somebody gives me, like, shows me a picture and asks me for critique, I'll critique it. But if I look at a picture and someone shows me something and I know they're not looking for critique, I'm always quite hesitant to sort of say, oh, this is how you should do it, or anything like that, because you can get very opinionated with your art and say, oh, that's wrong, that's not how it should look, that's not how a game should look, that's not how art should look, and I don't agree with that at all. You know, I think everyone should have their style, and it's, you can sort of fall into the trap of going, oh, I don't need to learn that because my style doesn't need that. But it's not always about that, you know. Sometimes you enjoy painting a certain way, and if the art looks fine, you know, and if it's got a distinct charm to it, then you don't always have to learn to do it the proper way. I mean, and I think it's very powerful to learn to do the thing a proper way, but you don't have to learn to do a thing the proper way if you don't choose. You know, people. Like, I'll bring up Ben Jordan 1, for example, because I know how much you hate the art in the original Ben Jordan 1.
I it's kind of you to call it art.
But, you know, at the time, I played it back then, and it did the job, you know? It was a good game, you know? It did
the job
need...
of working as a purgative.
It didn't need sort of these fancy backgrounds to achieve what it was trying to achieve, and... I'm not saying that doing an updated version was bad, because I think the updated version, well, obviously it does, looks much nicer, you know, but...
Yeah, but it still looks like shit comparatively now.
But that's the thing, you know, you'll always learn stuff along the way, and as long as you're producing art, and as long as it looks sort of a way that you're happy with... I know I had an aunt who was taking oil painting classes, and her teacher was, you know, was a good painter, but she'd have this thing where... she'd be painting along and the teacher would come along and say, oh, she'd go, oh, I'm not quite sure how to paint this thing. You know, they'd paint from photos rather than from life because they were interested in getting a whole range of scenes. Mm-hmm. And she'd say to the teacher, I'm not quite sure how to paint this. And the teacher would come and sort of push her out of the way and paint it for her.
Oh, yeah, my art teacher used to do that too.
Yeah, and every time she'd say, well, I don't really feel like I'm learning here because all you're doing is just painting for me instead of explaining... You know, telling her, you know, the light should hit from this side, this color should blend more to a red, or anything like that. She'd just sort of push her out of the way and say, you know, this is how it should be done. And she ended up not going to oil painting class anymore, and now just paints in oils at home, because she sort of felt like she wasn't learning. She was just, you know, I think it's important. And I see paint overs, and I've done paint overs myself, where afterwards you go, man, that was too much, you know? You get past the point where you can actually help someone, and you end up just going, this is how a good thing looks, yours doesn't look like this.
Yeah, which it's really hard to kind of I mean, it really all depends on your instructor as far as like art classes and when you're even just giving advice as paint overs. Yeah, it really, you really have to kind of stop yourself from just going and doing something rather than just suggesting.
Yeah. Because, and I think at any one point, you can look at anybody's backgrounds and go, oh, this is wrong, this looks wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But I think, especially if someone's asked you for advice and comes to you for advice, focus on the things that you can see improvement, you know, is sort of, it's not a huge leap. It's something that they can do right then and there and say, oh, this is something I'll take away. And then once they've learned to do that, next time. And the same for yourself, you know, because I mean, you know, you can try and say, right, I'm going to stop painting bad and tomorrow I'm going to paint good. Tomorrow I'm going to change my style completely because I paint bad and I want to paint really good. But it's not an instant thing. It's a gradual thing. That's why artists sketch. It's why artists sort of just muck around.
Well, one thing I wanted to say, too, before we get we keep going on the subject of style and not having to learn things. We were just having a conversation along these lines the other day where I was saying that you really shouldn't be stubborn and say that, you know, use your style as a crutch for not doing something properly. Like, if you don't do good perspective or you don't, you know, use colors correctly or something like that. I was using Picasso as an example. Like, however, you know, you see Picasso's classic paintings where the people's eyes are all wrong and, well, wrong. You know, it's not proper anatomy. And people say, oh, well, I don't understand why he's such a famous artist, whatever, he can't draw people. But he could, and he knew and he understood anatomy. He just chose to use that as his style. But, I mean, you know, it's not like he didn't know how to do it. It's not good to say, oh, well, I'm just going to develop this style where all of my perspective is crazy and cartoony so I don't have to learn proper perspective. I mean, I think it's important to have a range of skills and an understanding of how art works, because you can only break the rules or bend the rules when you understand the rules in the first place.
Yeah, it's very... I would say that one of the things I took away from my animation course was 50% of it was life drawing. And despite the fact, I mean, it's very obvious to people that do animation, but even when you're drawing very cartoony things and cartoony characters and cartoony animations, to have that grounded knowledge in, like, the way the muscles all kind of work and how the neck connects to the shoulders like this and that when you're doing life drawing, it's helped me immensely.
Mm. Mm. That's interesting, because I had the same like sort of illusion of, you know, I don't want to draw realistic looking people so I don't have to learn how people look in order to draw them cartoony. And I was wrong, man. And I suck at drawing people. That's like that's my worst thing. People are like the hardest thing to draw, except for like specifically hands on people, which are the hardest.
It's true. You can get stuck in ruts where you have a certain idea of how a hand looks and how legs look and stuff. But the more you start doing life drawing and you're getting that grounded understanding of it, the more you know how to draw different hands, different legs, even in a cartoony style, and how they work in an animation. So that's definitely, like, even now, I'm looking around at picking up more life drawing classes, because that would have been my biggest thing that I took away from the animation course.
It's definitely something that I want to learn to do better, and I've actually been working on it, is to draw people better. My sense of proportions is pretty bad, so, you know, it's something I know that I need to work on. You know, you will always have goals as an artist. And,
that's something I've always been pretty bad at, too. Like, my people, if I just draw from scratch without any reference or anything, my people end up looking pretty cartoony and the proportions are all wrong. Even though I have the knowledge and I know the measurements and everything, I just can't get it looking right. So that's why I tend to use photos as references for stuff. I mean, it really is all about the proportion, because, like, I mean, I rotoscope my animations and I guess I trace photos too, but I don't really trace exactly. I mean, I trace the outlines of the face and I kind of sketch in the nose and everything so I know where everything goes, but beyond that, I mean, I have an understanding of facial construction and facial shading and stuff, and I feel that I've really improved on that. Like, you know, I can actually draw a pretty good looking shaded nose in like 2 minutes now, which before, you know, it used to look terrible. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it is important. Practice really is important, because, like, you know, you look at your old stuff. I mean, I look at my old stuff from 10 years ago, and it's awful. I mean, not that I'm really happy. I've kind of found a technique and a style that I'm pleased with now, but I still feel that I have plenty of room for improvement. But I don't do like Ben. I don't practice every single day. I don't do speed paintings every day. Whereas I think if I did, I probably would have improved a lot faster than... I mean, I've had a pretty gradual improvement, but it's taken, you know, 10 plus years. So... Mm. Who knows? Maybe in 20 years, when I'm dead, I'll be the first octogenarian game designer.
Well, you know, if you're dead in 20 years, I'm sorry, but you're not going to make it to old age.
I'm just exaggerating.
People have said to me, like, "Oh man, Ben's improved so quickly. You know, how quickly he's learned." And I'll be honest, man, there's been a lot of drawings between then and now. You know, It's not like, oh, I did a drawing a week and all of a sudden I got, you know, better at painting. Like, I draw a lot, you know. Yeah. I remember when I was really learning how to paint, I was doing like a picture every half hour and just constantly doing pictures and pictures and pictures and pictures. Yeah. You know, so there's no real shortcut. There's no easy way, I don't think, to just go, oh yeah, I've learned how to draw. Woohoo.
No, you know. There's no art version of steroids or something else. That was the only
steroids,
thing I could think of.
Steroids take a long time to work anyway, don't they?
Do they? I don't know.
I don't know. I've never pumped iron. I've never sort of...
I love that you're still... I think you're the only person left in the world who still calls it pumping iron.
I've never got ripped.
You've never gotten...
To quote your friend Ken.
Yes. You've never gotten shredded.
Don't people call it pumping iron anymore?
No, they haven't called it pumping iron since that documentary with Arnold Schwarzenegger where he talks about coming.
I'm coming all day, every day. This is like.
It's like coming.
I'm coming here. I'm coming at home. I'm always coming.
I'm spooging the coming all over your weights. Don't touch them after me. That's how I claim them.
Yeah, that's no. He comes a lot. Arnold.
He does. He really likes his exercise.
He likes pumping iron.
Yeah,
I don't, man. See, I still think of it as pumping iron because every time I see like sort of beefcake like jocks like drinking protein shakes and like, whoa, you know, and they got like biceps the size of my head. I'm just like, man, he's been pumping iron.
But nobody says that anymore. It's cute. It's dated. It's a thing. But, you
I
know,
love
yeah,
the idea of
there's
like,
no...
and, like people like comparing like how much do you bench. But, oh man, my quads got a real workout. Well, you know, my triceps are really kind of nice. I love that idea. Oh man,
it's
I'm
just
sorry.
Like
I shouldn't
else.
Pick on people's hobbies, but
no, I was going to say there's also no one weird trick that you learn from a housewife to get your you know, improve your art using this one weird trick.
Painting according to BuzzFeed.
Yeah, exactly.
BuzzFeed School of Art, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Man, I love. Do you get all those? Speaking of art and Photoshop and pumping iron, do you get those Facebook ads where it's like ridiculously Photoshop, like beyond realistic? Like, oh, get ripped in 6 weeks and look like this guy, and he's like his pecs are bigger than his head. It takes quite a talent to do that, I think.
I don't think I've got one of those.
You need to use Facebook more.
I'm sorry, man. I'm ashamed. I'll have to go on Facebook more. I don't go on Facebook much. I'll have to get on there and sort of check this out.
Yeah. Didn't I send you? I think. Didn't I send you? Oh no. That was the Starbucks card. Never mind. Anyway, we're getting off topic here. Do we have anything else to discuss, or should we wrap up? We're going kind of. We're almost hitting the 2 hour mark.
We are not.
Well, it's 1 hour and 38 minutes.
Is it?
This is our longest podcast yet. You've been our most interesting guest, Dane.
I'm worried. I'm sad because I think Dane's been kind of sitting there patiently while you and I talk to each other.
Oh yeah, you're right. Well,
no,
Dane,
no,
now
no,
it's
no.
your turn. Now you
I'm
have
sorry.
The floor. Speak your mind, Dane. Go for it.
I have nothing to add.
Oh.
Have you got? What about Fun. What games are you looking forward to in the coming year, Dane Crams?
Yes.
Well, again, Journey Advisor. That is, honestly, yes. When I saw those screenshots, I don't think I've been more excited apart from Broken Age for an adventure game. It looked amazing. Mm. Mm.
Yeah, it really does. Good.
Good. I'll just settle with that.
Okay, good. No, I look forward to playing it as well. The champion.
Yeah.
Okay, well then I guess we can wrap things up. So, Dane, if people want to follow you on Twitter or get to know you more, do you have a website or Twitter? This is your time for some shameless self-promotion. Go.
Yeah, no, but because of the contract work that I'm in at the moment, and because it's still hush-hush, the website's really... Yeah, follow on Twitter, Crams Design on Twitter. I'm there mostly talking about art and games and rambling about tennis or something. Putting drunken photos up, if you want to see that.
Mm. Well, those are... Yes. Photos of... never mind. I'm not gonna bring that up.
Let's continue. Let's continue. Yes.
All right, good. Well, yeah, you can follow me at Grunislav Games on Twitter, and GrunislavGames.com, I guess. I've never really promoted my website before, but yeah.
Good.
I changed my Twitter profile today.
Did you?
Yeah.
Ew. I haven't changed mine for ages because mine sums me up perfectly.
I made mine a bit more representative of myself.
God, you're so serious. I bet you made it like, oh, butts are nice.
go have a look for yourself. You'll see.
I'm pretty excited. I'm going to do it right now. You'll hear my reaction live.
Okay.
I'm searching here. Look, here we go. I know Twitter that well that I'm going to find you straight away.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Here's your profile. Clicking on this, loading it up. I see. That, yeah, I can get behind that. Oh good. Man, look at your look at your recent photos. You got me wearing my glasses. Or... It's pretty. Anyway,
you don't want to get Twitter behind as well. Me if I've eaten Brian.
No, I'll know. I'll hear it because we're always Skyping. I'm on Twitter as well, but you're not allowed to follow me, so don't you dare even think about it. And if you follow me and you're listening, unfollow me right now. I'm not even going to tell you my Twitter handle, so there, the end. Thank you for being on our podcast, Dane. It was a delight having you along.
Yes, and, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And if you ever want to come back and talk more about art stuff, well...
Or anything.
Or anything. Or anything. You're more than welcome to come back.
If you want
to
have like a 1 hour rant at how hard it was to fix the blind that I apparently broke. But I will say this. Who moved your refrigerator from the garage into your kitchen?
Oh, that's true. That is
That was me. That was all me. So there you
who
go.
Helped you? Who helped you get home when you fell asleep on the bus?
He didn't fall asleep on the bus. He fell asleep on the bus floor of the bus station. And I was like, Dave, what bus do we have to take? I got no idea. Oh, man, I was laughing so much. That was a good time. Man, we had good times.
I wish I had seen that. Oh, well.
Oh, man. You've not seen me giggle until you put me in a situation like that where I'm absolutely horrified of, like, walking the 20 miles or whatever it is to get back to Dave.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Especially when we missed the last bus the night before by 1 minute.
Yep. I got my poor old mum to drive out at like 3 in the morning or something.
I saved her from a roach. I think like that was kind of like, you know. It's all good. It all evens out. Karma is very balanced and fair. Good. Mm. All right.
Yeah, all right.
Once again, Dane, thank you for being along. It was an absolute pleasure having you along.
Yes.
Mm. Thank you.
And stay tuned for another episode of the Blue Cup Tools podcast, which will be episode 35. Man, that's a lot of podcasts.
It is a lot of podcasts. What are we doing with our lives?
Podcast.
I don't know. Let's go and be sad about it. Bye.
Goodbye.